It is 5:03. You are listening to CFRC 101.9 FM and on the web at cfrc.ca. We are broadcasting live from the basement of Carruthers Hall in Kingston, Ontario. Good evening, everybody, and welcome to Radio 613. I'm Malka.
And I'm Avi.
And we're glad to be on air this evening. This week, we are going to be talking about Sukkot, as the holiday is nearing an end. We will feature an interview with Sam Kuhn from the Tenant Action Group in Belleville. And we'll also be discussing the Sukkot-themed film Ushpizin and some more discussion around Sukkot.
A few weeks ago, on our most recent show, we spoke about the Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur period, and we're now in the sixth day of the holiday of Sukkot, and Sukkot, in a number of ways, presents a significant contrast to Yom Kippur. While during Yom Kippur we talk about, we recognize it as a time where we encounter and reflect upon the possibility of death, as well as our actions in the world over the last year, Sukkot very much symbolizes birth and the force of life. So to begin with, Sukkot, and connected to that idea of life and sustenance, it's a harvest festival. So we appreciate what gives us life in that respect. Sukkot also commemorates the experience of wandering in the wilderness during the Exodus period from Egypt. So as such, Jews on Sukkot build a sukkah, a temporary hut that we dwell in for the 7 days. It acts as a reminder of the temporariness of material things, of a roof over our heads, even. So there are a number of laws pertaining to building a sukkah that are meant to ensure that the structure is a sufficient place to dwell over that 7 day period, but also to ensure that the hut that you're building is definitely a temporary one. So we built the sukkah this year, Malka.
Yes, we did. Well, I didn't participate a lot in the building of the sukkah. I was mostly moral support, but you did. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, and I've got my fellow builder in studio here.
Yeah, I participated in building it as well.
Why don't you introduce yourself to the listeners?
Yeah, I'm Sean, and I built the sukkah.
Claim to
Avi, of course.
Claim to fame. Yeah, we did some skill sharing there with the sukkah, and I got to practice my drill skills and whatnot. So what did we have to do, Sean, to make sure that we sort of met the halachic requirements of building a hut to dwell in, but making sure that it's temporary, and how do we go about doing that?
Well, I guess in our case, we really were dealing with a limited amount of space, so we just used sort of a porch that sits off of the house. And we use some 2x4s that are kind of attached to the wrought iron railings of the porch with sort of U-bolts that go through them and around these other... I don't know how specific you want me to get, but anyway, so... Yeah, they went through and around the railing to hold it in place, and so you wouldn't consider that anything but temporary in any stretch of the imagination. And then we... you know, that gave us 3 posts off the side of the house, and then we put a bunch of 2x4s that we screwed into the trim of just under the roof, and put some pieces of wood over top between the bars that stick up with another bar on top, and then pieces of wood across, and then we put some corn on top of it, and then we made the outsides with sheets.
Colorful cloth.
Yes. Yeah, you're meant to decorate it and make a nice place to dwell in as well. And yeah, so you have to have 3 walls, I believe. And again, with the roof is made out of, we made it out of corn, but it can be any other sort of organic material, and you call it tzchach, and meant to allow enough lights so that rain can come in, but more shade, although the squirrels were threatening the halachic legitimacy of our
and
roof.
Structural integrity.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I don't think we'd use corn again. It's a little too tasty, perhaps. I'm going to find something else. It's getting attacked daily. Yeah.
But I guess I can take this on-air opportunity to say thanks to both of you for building the lovely sukkah. I've been enjoying spending time in it, as presumably you have too.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it's been great having people over, and we'll talk a little later in the show about having guests, ushpizim, in the sukkah. Certainly the experience of building it, but also sitting in there, I'm not sure how you feel, Sean, but I think it is really powerful in recognizing really what we need to live and what we need to live under, but also to remember that experience of wandering and to remember and also to put ourselves in that place always of temporariness and talk about issues around housing and access to housing and that sort of thing.
Yeah, it's pretty hard to forget how nice it is and what a blessing it is to have a house when you're sitting in the rain in the sukkah. So I think that's a good reminder of how good things are and how people don't have things good. And we'll talk about that later, I guess.
Yeah, I think on that note, I'd like to just introduce an interview that I was happy to do yesterday with Sam Kuhn, who's a longtime housing activist who now lives in Belleville, and he's been involved in some very interesting direct action activism around housing and homelessness. So let's hear what he's got to say. So I am on the phone with Sam Kuhn, who is an organizer and worker at the Organic Underground Cafe in Belleville and a longtime tenant activist in Belleville and Ontario. So, Sam, thanks so much for being on the show with me today.
My pleasure.
So, first off, I just wanted to ask you a little bit about what kind of activist work you've done around housing and tenant organizing.
I've done a great deal of work in community legal clinics, representing tenants before tribunals, as well as just advocating for affordable housing in general, provincially and federally, and also organizing, being part organizer of a group that's called Tenant Action Group in Belleville.
Okay, and can you tell us a little bit more about the Tenant Action Group?
Yeah, it's mostly a collection of single moms, and we work a loose group of low-income tenants, and we work as a collective, and we work by consensus, and we engage in direct action tactics to reinstate people if they've been illegally or even legally evicted, representing people at the housing tribunal, involved with the Ontario Common Front and doing squad actions and helping out OCAP in Toronto. Sometimes we'll go to places like Sudbury and represent tenants for housing groups up there as well. So that's the kind of work.
Okay, and what kind of sort of successes have you seen in your work with tenant organizing and the Tenant Action Group in particular in Belleville?
Over the years, we've seen a great deal of successes, whether it's going to court and representing tenants or going to the tribunal, Human Rights Commission. I think but the most rewarding and most successful has been engaging in direct action tactics, where you skirt the courts and help out tenants that way.
Okay, that's great. I'd love it if you could speak to that a little bit more. I know that there have been some links, as you mentioned, with OCAP in the past, and OCAP has obviously a very rich history of direct action tactics around issues of poverty, all kinds of stuff, and homelessness. And I'm wondering if you can speak a little bit to some of the direct action techniques that you've used specifically related to housing.
Okay. Very often we find that that housing also includes people who are being harassed by their employers or hydro cutoffs. You know, someone lines in a home and their hydro or gas is being cut off. So what we've done over the last couple of years, and really through the model of OCAP, they've really inspired us, mm-hmm. is to things like organizing tenant associations within apartment buildings, engaging in rent strikes, welfare office occupations, hydro utility office occupations, things of that nature, reinstating people physically who've been locked out of their homes, so actually getting back inside, and so that's sort of direct action. We've also been involved with doing squats, seizing empty buildings, and trying to get them turned into affordable housing.
Wow. So with all kinds of direct action techniques, like the ones you've described, you know, there is always the threat, and often, more often than not, the realization of repression techniques used by police or landlords or government employees in response to squats or reclamations or whatever kind of actions are being carried out. You know, maybe you can speak a little bit to that experience. And I'm also wondering more specifically, though, what instances there may or may not have been of sort of a more conciliatory attitude from, you know, the opponent, as it were.
Conciliatory from the opponent, or like a more conciliatory approaches?
Yeah, conciliatory approaches, okay. From the part of the landlord or from the part of the, well, not the police, but...
My background has been working for community legal clinics, mm-hmm. right? And in those offices, you have lawyers. So my job would have been job description, community legal worker. And in that capacity, I'd be organizing or working for the Federation of Metro Tenants Associations, a tenant union in Toronto. And so for years and years, we did that, you know, going to the tribunal, going to the courts prior to the tribunal, and meeting with success. That was fine. But really, when things got horribly bad under Harris, then we found it necessary to engage in much more direct confrontational tactics in order to help tenants. And what we found was not only was that much more successful, all right? Because,
right.
I mean, the procedures for tenants who are evicted or they're being harassed by the landlord or having their hydro cut off, the system in place in Ontario really could not cope with that. There was very little, there was no process to get tenants reinstated.
Mm-hmm.
You know, reinstated if they've been illegally locked out or their hydro back on if the landlord had cut it off or something along those lines. And so there was a real need to engage in much more direct action tactics. And what we found was that us as activists would often go in and inform the tenants of their rights and kind of help to organize them. But they always took the leadership. They're always the ones who were at the forefront, who were the more aggressive ones, who and once they tasted success, then it would carry like wildfire, okay, at least in our town anyway, where it was not unusual to see, you know, 50 or 60 poor people marching down the streets, front street here,
wow.
The local MPP's office to occupy it or to harass the MPP for things like special diet cuts or things along those, things that impacted negatively upon poor people. And as far as conciliatory, I mean, we always are, in the groups that we've belonged to, we've always been conciliatory in the sense that we always try to talk to the landlord first, or we try to talk to the welfare worker or hydro office, you know, and then if we can't sort things out in a conciliatory way, then we very clearly write a letter outlining our demands and giving them a deadline to respond, and if they don't, then we take immediate action. You know, so it's never just some crazy people running down the streets attacking people or landlords and stuff like that. It's always sort of we try to use peaceful methods first, but when the system, as it invariably is unreasonable, then we're prepared to fight back. To, you know,
right.
Yeah.
And I think that I was a little unclear. What I meant was, have you seen any moments of conciliatory actions taken by landlords in response to direct action techniques?
They back down. Whether it's, you know, I think it's very important for activists who engage in this sort of these tactics not to exaggerate or not to tell war stories, right?
Right.
To say how it is. And someone like me, who comes from a legal background, many years in the legal clinic system, you know, where we had to do things properly through proper procedures, through the courts, and all that stuff. We discovered that direct action was not only did you get results, mm-hmm. right, but it was also an amazing mobilizing tool, empowering tool for mm-hmm. the people engaged in it. So, you know, like I said, and we mostly organize with single moms, low-income moms in housing projects and things like that.
Yep.
And they then go on to become leaders and often the most aggressive ones.
That's one thing that I would really like to hear about more from you, actually, is in my, limited political experience, one thing that I've found is that sometimes taking action not only has, pragmatic positive outcomes politically, but it also affects the people who are involved in really positive and empowering ways.
I've heard the word life-changing so often.
Mm-hmm.
And many low-income people are isolated, and, of course, their self-esteem is low, and many of the women we organize with come out of abusive situations, and now they believe in themselves again. They believe in the power of people joining together, and also they see them as no longer undeserved, but mm-hmm. that they deserve housing. They deserve to be able to feed their kids. They deserve to be able to go to a dentist or get glasses or all those things that welfare or disability routinely denies them, you know. So they have a stake in, not wording it well. They start to demand their basic rights. You know, they're no longer being walked over.
One thing that you've mentioned, and I think you've been speaking about, are tenant unions.
Yep.
So maybe some of our listeners are not very familiar with a union outside of the context of workers and labor.
Yeah.
So maybe you could explain that a little bit.
Well, across Canada, most urban centers, there's each building will often, probably not usually, but the ones that are organized in association, and that's a loose. There's no rules about that. You know, sometimes they have constitutions, sometimes they don't. Sometimes they're middle class, sometimes they're poor people or different cultural groups or ethnic groups, things like that. So, and in places like Toronto, they have the Federation of Metro Tenants Associations. In Vancouver, they have, I forget the name of the union there. It's very rare. In places like New York, of course, they have stronger, but they're very rare entities because it's very difficult for tenants to organize. They tend to move around a lot. They tend to be isolated, not aware of their rights and things. So there's not too many. But in places like the more radical, mostly anarchist, like Peterborough, Guelph, Kingston, Belleville, these small communities have more radical tenant unions.
Mm-hmm.
They're not called tenants unions. Like in Guelph, they have Guelph Union of Tenants and Supporters, or the Peterborough Coalition Against Poverty, or Kingston Coalition Against Poverty. So you may see a name of a group, but they're actually a tenant union. But they also include things like welfare and disability and human rights, and then they're connected to sometimes the anti-corporate globalization movement,
mm-hmm.
struggles for Palestine or native solidarity, you know? And so those are the more inspiring ones, not like the ones in Toronto, like the Federation of Metro Tenants Associations, which really do very little, and are more middle class and legal oriented and law reform. But I think the cutting edge is the small communities that are starting to organize across Ontario, across Canada.
So in Belleville, through the tenant
action group.
Tenant action group, thank you. What kind of solidarity work or work outside of the housing and tenancy issue has the group been engaged with?
You mean with other communities, possibly?
With other communities,
yeah.
Or yeah.
Well, we organized what was called the Ontario Common Front, under the leadership of the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty.
Mm-hmm.
And like when we were starting off, when I was working in the legal clinic, OCAP sent out Sean Brandt and Sue Collis to mobilize different communities around anti-poverty. They wanted to do what was called a campaign of economic disruption across the province against Harris. And so that really inspired us when Sean Brandt and Sue Collis, and we're close to Tyndonega, helped us out and basically taught us how to do welfare office occupation. And then once we got the first blood of that and we saw how successful and how easy it was, then we didn't need them any longer, right? And then we started, once we learned that, then we started going to help out OCAP in Toronto and represent tenants when they needed help, or in Sudbury, or in different communities, Guelph or something like that. So it was a really amazing linkage between all these different communities. We had people would come out from Guelph to support us, or so it was a very dynamic, grassroots, powerful, successful coalition of anti-poverty groups, and that ignored things like basic law reform or what the legal clinics were doing. It was made up of poor people themselves. Like in our group, we have meetings where we work by consensus, and it's not perfect. Sometimes we make mistakes and things, but for the most part, the people in our group have a say, and they have they give direction to what we're doing.
You mentioned that it was Sean Brandt and Sue Collis who first kind of introduced you or taught you, as you said, how to occupy welfare offices. Now, more recently, Sean Brandt and Sue Collis and other people at Tyndonega have been involved in land reclamation at the quarry site at Tyndonega. And Sean has faced a huge legal battle, which he seems to be coming out of on top pretty well. Have you been involved, or have people in Belleville been involved in any sort of solidarity work with people on Tyndonega?
Oh yeah, we were asked about a month or 2 months ago. Things are moving pretty fast here. So recently, anyways, we were, because our expertise is tenant organizing, that's just what we've done. The tenants in Tyndonega, mostly women and elders, were facing a rash of evictions by the band council and disrepair. And the housing authority, the housing office in Tyndonega, was just acting unbelievably just disorganized and, like I said, evicting people and not responding to repairs. Just from every level in Tyndonega, the housing was just an awful straits. So they asked us to come in to help them out, and so we attended a meeting, and then we sort of organized the tenant association. Then we went to the band council meeting, and that's where they demanded that these women, there were three women and an elder, who were illegally evicted. But there's no provincial or federal laws to protect these tenants, right?
Right.
So so they got nowhere at the band council meeting, and then after the meeting, lasted until like 11 or 12 o'clock at night, then everyone got back in their cars and or the pickup trucks, and they found an empty home that was owned by the band council, and they moved a woman back in. They broke in and moved, and then they guarded the place with warriors all night.
Wow.
So that, certainly we were not taking leadership with that. We were just helping out.
Mm-hmm.
But we were honored to be asked to come down and to participate in that, So, and we recently had a film showing of Gana Satage, where we have, we have lots of people at our cafe here, and we have we had native speakers, and we had drumming going on. So we try to act as support, because we think it's really, really important in a town like Belleville, where the newspapers, it's two main newspapers all owned by the same company, and they're rabidly anti-Native, horribly so. And so it's really important for non-Aboriginal people like myself and the people in our group to show support in practical ways. And we're doing that, and it's a lot of fun. It's inspiring, because I've never seen people do that. If someone's illegally evicted, just move them back in like that and then post a guard, It was appropriate and it was practical and it was inspiring.
That's really great to hear. There's an Indigenous solidarity network here in Kingston that's been working in solidarity mostly with the occupation in Tyndinega,
yeah,
and done some work days out there and building some relationships, as well as doing a lot of sort of educational, popular education and advocacy work in Kingston. And I think for myself, sometimes there's a lot to be done always on the advocacy, or not advocacy, but on the education, popular education front. And it's, really valuable work. Sometimes you want to seek to do something a little bit maybe more pragmatic or practical. And so I'm wondering, when you're talking about the sort of assistance that the tenant action group provided to the tenants at Tyndinega, what sort of concretely, what kind of assistance did you actually provide? How were you actually able to support them?
Well, because there's no federal provincial laws that govern landlord tenants in a native territory like that, it was really actually there was this huge opportunity now to have the tenants and the band council sit down and write out their own laws, right? And so the idea was, from the women and the elders, the idea was to create a system that incorporated native traditional ways of resolving disputes, and at the same time making it kind of a legal process as well, right? So and so that was really interesting, that we sat down with the chief and some of the other counselors. We had many, many different meetings that would stretch all day, right? We're up until 11 o'clock at night, because we were all determined that we weren't going to leave, and they're going to do sit-ins, right? And so so we were helping them in that way, in that making sure that there was a process that protected the tenants, and they would always push us to make sure that we would have to try to incorporate their traditional ways. So, for instance, if you are facing eviction and you right now there's no appeal process, right? So what we're trying to work on is an appeal process that would actually go to a model, a system, an appeal process that's modeled after how the Mohawks used to handle disputes. And so right now it's sort of drafted that way, but we're still in meetings, and we've gotten actually nowhere so far, but it's a work in progress, right? So,
Well, I hope things continue to progress positively. It's very interesting to hear you talking about seeking ways of doing things from sort of traditional sources. In Jewish law, there are laws around tenancy and landlords, and some of the laws have to do with, it's illegal to evict a tenant without due notice,
right,
in the winter months, and there's responsibility on the landlord they're supposed to be. Legally, through Jewish law, halachically, there is responsibility on the landlord if an eviction results in homelessness for the tenant.
Yeah.
So, these are some of the things that are very relevant and timely in the current holiday of Sukkot, and are, these are the reasons that I wanted to talk to you, but it's also stuff that's, you know, strikes a chord with me personally as something to which I can look in, you know, my tradition.
I mean, we saw that in, it was a huge learning experience for myself, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the other people in our group who went there. And we were just thrilled at being able to watch the internal politics.
Mm-hmm.
And then when we talked about, you know, we suggested, well, what you need is an appeal process, right? So that if the housing office makes a mistake, and then they would then push and say, well, if we're going to appeal it, we want it to go in this manner, in this way, because this is how traditionally Mohawks would deal with it. And they saw the non-traditionals, or the short hairs, as basically, you know, they as white society, really.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And so it was the long hairs going against the short hairs, and the traditionals were winning. The chief saw them day after day after day, and spent many, many hours, and is spending many, many hours, and is conceding because they're right based on their tradition. You know, they just don't throw people out, you know, unless it goes through a certain process.
Right.
And it sounds like same thing with in Jewish tradition as well.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Great. Well, you know, I wish you all the best in the groups that you're involved with, continual activism in Belleville. And, you know, keep your eye out for linkages with Kingston.
Definitely.
And thank you so much for sharing so much on the show today.
It's been a pleasure.
That was Sam Kuhn from the Tenant Action Group in Belleville, who I interviewed yesterday. I wanted to add a couple of things to something I mentioned about, you know, Jewish laws surrounding landlord and tenant relations. In terms of the responsibility on the landlord when a tenant becomes homeless as a result of eviction, that was an interpretation of law by Moses Maimonides. And beyond those laws around eviction, Jewish law requires landlords to keep rented units habitable. So they're required to fix doors and windows and ceilings, and there are interpretations that stress that it is the tenant who defines what is acceptable and rather than the landlord. So those are some other, like, really progressive laws in halachic laws that I want to share with you.
Thanks for that, Malka, and thanks for the interview. It was great to hear Sam Kuhn's thoughts and about the work that he's doing. And towards the end, he spoke about the solidarity work that he's participating in with regard to housing at Tyndanega. And I just wanted to add, I think it's important, especially during Sukkot, when we're thinking about Israel's exodus, about wandering and displacement, to also think and act in a broader anti-colonial context. You know, for us as settlers on Turtle Island, to remember that our current homes are on stolen indigenous land, and that settlements continue and state policies continue the dispossession of indigenous peoples at Tyndanega, Caledonia, and elsewhere across Turtle Island. So with that, we're going to get into a track produced by Kesalam and Beatnik, words by Suher Hamad, called Refugees, and coming up, we'll be talking about the film Ush Bizim.
For refugees everywhere, from Palestine to New Orleans, we're finding our folk. I do not wish to place words in living mouths or bury the dead dishonorably. I am not deaf to cries escaping shelters that citizens are not refugees. Refugees are not Americans. I will not use language one way or another to accommodate my comfort. I will not look away. All I know is this. No peoples ever choose to claim status of dispossessed. No peoples want pity above compassion. No enslaved peoples ever call themselves slaves. What do we pledge allegiance to? A government that leaves its own to die of thirst, surrounded by water, is a foreign government. People who are streaming illiterate into paperwork have long ago been abandoned. I think of coded language and all that words carry on their backs. I think of how it is always the poor who are tagged and boxed with labels not of their own choosing. I think of my grandparents and how some call them refugees. Others call them non-existent. They call themselves landless, which means homeless. Before the hurricane, no tents were prepared for the fleeing, because Americans do not live in tents. Tents are for Haiti, for Bosnia, for Rwanda. Refugees are the rest of the world, those left to defend their human decency against conditions the rich keep their animals from. Those who have too many children, those who always have open hands and empty bellies, those whose numbers are massive, those who seek refuge from nature's currents and man's resources, those who are forgotten in the meantimes, those who remember. Ahmed from Guinea makes my falafel sandwich and says, so, this is your country? Yes, Amadou, this my country, and these my people. Evacuated as if criminal, rescued by neighbors, shot by soldiers, adamant they belong. The rest of the world can now see what I have seen. Do not look away. The rest of the world lives here too, in America.
Welcome back to the show. What was that track, Abby?
That was Refugees by Suher Hamad.
That was a nice tunes. Well, we're going to move on to a little discussion of the movie Ushpizin. And we've got Sean still in the studio, who's ready to share some info about that. It's an Israeli movie that was released in August 2004, and it's centered around Sukkot.
Yeah, I guess this is like the third time I've seen this movie. I just watched it again today to remind myself. I thought it was a really good movie. I mean, I thought it was really good the first time I saw it. I saw it again, and I think it's actually better than I thought it was before. So it's basically the story of Moshe and Malka, who are a couple married living in Jerusalem. They're Barshlov, Chesed's. Basically, Moshe used to be kind of, I don't know how to say it, he was at one time someone who was not religious and I guess not fairly lawless, I guess you would say a thug. And he had basically become extremely religious, become part of the Barshlov movement, and became a rabbi. And so he was having a lot of trouble. I mean, in a way, it relates to the other thing. Malka and Moshe were pretty broke. They're about to sort of, they're behind on their rent. You sort of feel this impending threat of eviction about to happen. I guess, spoiler alert here, this is an old movie, so I figure people have seen it if they want to. And if they don't, my interpretation of it won't be as good as watching it. I can guarantee that, so... Anyways, he didn't have enough money to buy materials for a sukkah. He didn't have enough money to buy the four species. He's just sort of broke and out of his luck. And so the movie is a sort of exploration of him going through praying for to have money, but also to make his wife happy, because they also have the bad luck of not being able to have a child, which is sort of, you know, a bad sentence for the marriage in that community, for him being a rabbi. So basically these friends show up, Ushpizim, the unexpected guests, so an old friend, one of them's an old friend of his, and they had skipped out on prison, basically. I think they'd been let go on leave probably for Yom Kippur, and they decided they weren't going to go back to prison. They didn't like it. So the one friend found out where Moshe lived and decided to go there. And so basically, they're extremely, I guess, sort of violent and alcoholic or whatnot, and they kind of ruin the Sukkot holiday in a way. But really, the real story, I think, behind it is one of change. And it's a story about the way in which Moshe deals with the challenges that are set for him and the tests that are involved in his change from his past life when he's confronted with someone that comes from his past. And I think that's like, you know, one of the more important things is the way in which people change and how that happens. And I think that him being confronted with this person who, you know, is sort of a mirror of what he used to be, he starts to see not only is he that he's really different, but also it threatens that difference because maybe some of the difference isn't actually fully cemented. And a lot of it maybe has just been stuffed or sort of, Moshe's just kind of cut it off and thrown it away, you know, but it doesn't really go anywhere. And so Moshe's rabbi himself was sort of giving him that advice in, you know, his, in a sort of cryptic way, just trying to help him think about what was going on. So I thought it was pretty interesting just to see the struggles of, like, from, you know, people who are pretty poor in Jerusalem and the way in which people interact with each other. I think it was pretty nice. And just sort of the way in which at the end you see both Moshe's friend and the friend of Moshe's friend who was along for the ride, sort of the way they change and the way that Moshe changes in, you know, in fighting off his, like, evil urge and fighting off anger, you know, he was able to basically move through this test and have things work out in the end. You know, it's a happy ending. I'll put it that way.
I remember a good moment in the film in which Moshe had bought a lovely etrog, which is one of the four traditional ritual species that you have during Sukkot, and it's a type of citrus that is lovely and very aromatic, and people get like really nice, very fragrant and beautiful etrogs. And so he had gotten a really nice one, and it was like a really special thing for the family, and for the family. And so, and then at one point he finds his guests, his old quote-unquote thug friend and his friend, have cut the etrog and eaten it.
Well, and the funny thing about that is that, well, you know, they would realize when they had caused this big scene in the middle of this, like, Hasidic community to the point where all of his neighbors are staring at him, it basically ruined his life. Malka, his wife, has, like, run away, and, you know, he's just at the bottom. They're like, they came to the realization that they were just not very nice people and that they, you know, it wasn't fair what they were doing. They came to realize that this wasn't just a shtick for him and that he really was religious, and that he had, like, gone about change. And so they decided to make him a really good meal. And so they used that etrog in the meal and cut it up.
Right.
So when he realized which one it was, because he knew he didn't have any lemons, and so then he just has this moment where that's like a sort of almost, I don't know, it's like a test. It's like all of his rage, because he used to be like a street fighter. So all of his rage came out, and he was at that point where it was like, you know, he was either going to beat them up or run away and deal with it. And so it's a very emotional part of the movie. I remember, you know, sort of crying at the scene where he runs off into the woods by himself and he's standing there just like, you know, screaming, like, what is it? You know, what do you want from me? Hmm. And it's like, I think the answer to the movie is that he wanted, you know, that the issue is that he should, that's what he wanted, basically, is to go out into the woods and scream instead of, like, becoming angry. It was like the final test, I guess, in a metaphorical sense for the movie.
And it seems to me that I had forgotten, actually, I didn't watch the movie recently. I've watched it a long time ago, and I had forgotten that it was in the process of making a sort of conciliatory meal that the Ushpizin guests were destroyed, as it were, the etrog. And it's kind of one way of looking at that, maybe, is that, you know, those were good intentions without knowledge, and so, like, in a way it backfired, and so you need to not only have, like, good intentions and a good heart, but you also have to have knowledge to back it up.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. Yeah, I think also, like, the good intentions of Moshe's, like, changes were also not fully cemented, in the sense that he needed to do some more of the emotional work, like just knowledge itself couldn't bring about the change, that there was some necessity for there to be this real emotional test where he could prove to himself that he was able, without just stuffing it. I mean, I don't know if you've ever known anyone that's gone through a big change where they had problems with anger or something, and they would just pretend like it never didn't exist anymore. But I think that's kind of like what he was doing in that movie, the character. And so this is the test, is to see that because in that way it doesn't actually get worked through. What he was doing is like working through the issues that he had that were behind the anger that had plagued him in his previous life, you know?
Mm-hmm. Thanks for that, resident movie watcher.
No worries.
Okay, this is Golem and The Rent.
Dirigent!
Ay, ay, ay.
Dirigent!
Боже мой!
Dirigent!
Ungarn!
Ladies and gentlemen, we interrupt our program of dance music to bring you a special bulletin from the Intercontinental Radio News.
On October 30th, 1938, more than 32 million listeners tuned into their radios and heard a broadcast that brought widespread panic throughout the United States.
A hissing sound.
Earthquake intensity occurring within a radius of 20 miles of Princeton.
Join CFRC in the John Orr Room upstairs in the J-Duck at 7 p.m. on October 30th for a free live listening party. Or tune in to 101.9 FM on the same date and time as we rebroadcast Orson Welles' radio drama, War of the Worlds.
Listen, please.
70 years after its first airing.
Do you hear it?
Okay, welcome back to the show. That last song there was The Rent, and it's from Fresh Off Boat by the band Golem, New York City, and the music label is J-Dub Records. If you're interested, J-Dub Records. com, I think. Thanks a lot again for that movie review, Haush Bizin. Again, you can get that in town here at Classic Video, but I'm going to watch it. You've convinced me. I haven't seen the film, but sounds great. And something else that I've really been appreciating, Sukkot, was this idea of Haush Bizin, of having guests in the sukkah for the week, and it's something that one is really encouraged to do, to have guests, important people in your life come in. It's I don't know source, but you're encouraged to bring in non-Jews, so people from every element of the community into the sukkah, celebrate life and sort of experience this together. And this idea of the four kinds, that the lulav and the etrog, different species, has to do partly with different kinds of people and how our own person is intertwined with those around us, and that our our strengths and weaknesses, connected to those around us, and that we require support from people around us, and that's mutual as well. So that's something I really appreciate. And another thing that we remember is act and think as if there are people who might not be physically in the sukkah with us, but are spiritually there. So, you know, we're meant to think of the matriarchs and patriarchs as well as various Jewish teachers, but also, you know, we can think of people in our lives. People, you know, I was definitely thinking about people who are in my life who have passed away in the last year. I myself was thinking of a friend and teacher, but also co-thinker, my friend Farouk, who passed away this year, and really thinking of him as if he was in there breaking bread and discussing in the sukkah. So that was a really great thing, and it's been nice to have people in.
Yeah, it's been really nice having the sukkah at the house where I live, because it's been so busy. I've been so busy lately, the past few months, relatively new job, working on my radio show and all kinds of other things. And I've, to a certain extent, besides the people that I'm closest to and who are, you know, with me on a daily basis, I've really neglected reaching out to other friends and acquaintances and making the time to spend time with people that I care about but who are less intimately related to my day-to-day life. And it's kind of interesting, having the sukkah gave me the opportunity to invite people over who I normally don't spend a lot of time with, and I had some really nice conversations and some nice connections. So a less religiously relevant but personally very nice sort of side benefit of the sukkah for this past week has been that I've got to spend some time with some nice people who I wouldn't have spent time with otherwise. And so we're coming to the end of the show. We've got a few minutes left. I just wanted to take the opportunity to remind our listeners of some upcoming events part of Islamic History Month. So this Wednesday, October 22nd, at 7 p.m., Dr. Ingrid Haymeyer is presenting a talk entitled Creativity in the Medical Sciences During Medieval Islamic Times. So that's going to be taking place in Dupuy Auditorium, in the Dupuy Building, which is on Union at Division. Is that right, Avi? Dupuy's Union at Division?
I think so.
Yeah, just actually, it's just north of Union on Division. Hope I'm not messing that up. I'm not a student anymore. And yeah, so 7 p.m. Wednesday, October 22nd. And also keep your ears open to some upcoming Islamic History Month events that will be happening on air on CFRC. There are some rebroadcasts of talks that were given last year in 2007. So tomorrow, October 21st, from 4 to 5 p.m., CFRC 101.9 FM, you can hear Imam Yasin Dwyer's 2007 Islamic History Month address on Islam in the Americas, a historical review of Muslim communities in the West.
That's it for the show this week.
Thanks for joining us. Tune in next week, 5 o'clock, to Radio 613.
The other become the reference of the self. C'est la diaspora.
People.
Les immigrants de tous les pays. Tous les pays.
C'est la diaspora.
J'aime beaucoup les pauvres. Par exemple, quand je serai vieux, j'espère que je serai vieux à Marseille.
The city.
Puis le diaspora, c'est la diaspora. L'identité du fils. Le couscous du Shabbat. C'est la diaspora.
Girl, man. Woman.
Everybody.
C'est la diaspora.